you've been here for a while, you'll remember we've been working steadily since the beginning of the year through Ecclesiastes when we have opportunity, and we've got now to halfway through chapter 7. And I'm going to be reading from chapter 7, verse 16 to chapter 8, verse 1. Be not overly righteous, and do not make yourself too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Be not overly wicked, neither be a fool. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you should take hold of this, and from that withhold not your hand. For the one who fears God shall come out from both of them. Wisdom gives strength to the wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. Surely there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. Do not take to heart all the things that people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. Your heart knows that many times you yourself have cursed others. All this I have tested by wisdom. I said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. That which has been is far off and deep, very deep. Who can find it out? I turn my heart to know and to search out and to seek wisdom in the scheme of things and to know the wickedness of folly and the foolishness that is madness. And I find something more bitter than death, the woman whose heart is snares and nets and whose hands are fetters. He who pleases God escapes her, but the sinner is taken by her. Behold, this is what I found, says the preacher, while adding one thing to another to find the scheme of things, which my soul has sought repeatedly, but I have not found. One man among 1,000 I found, but a woman among all these I have not found. See, this alone I found, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes. Who is like the wise, and who knows the interpretation of a thing? A man's wisdom makes his face shine, and the hardness of his face is changed. Do keep that open. And as ever, we've got some points on the inside of the sheet, which will be a help to you as we look at this. It's been observed, and it's pretty clear to most of us, that what most people think about religion in this country is shifting. And it's shifted especially, I think, over the last, people say, 50 years. So 50 years ago, I'm told, that religion was regarded as basically positive, but perhaps a bit prudish and restrictive around the edges. Then the shift happened and religion became more like an irrelevance. And then more recently, the feeling is that religion is actually dangerous and it needs to be resisted. And it's not just the obvious dangers of Islamic fundamentalism that people have in mind, but also that general sense that religion, in all its forms, causes self-righteous judgmentalism. That sense that religious people's obsession with right beliefs, right behaviour, just makes them intolerant, makes them critical of other people and their worldviews. Now, I would want to argue that this problem of self-righteous judgmentalism is not unique to religious people at all. It's just as it's easy to find religious people whose attitude is, well, at least I'm not like those awful, immoral, secular people, it's just as easy to find secular people who have the same attitude, but the other way around. Well, at least I'm not like those backward, judgmental, religious people. So I'd argue that this tendency that we see to self-righteousness is a much more widespread disease than many people realise. But as Christians, the fact that self-righteousness is widespread should not let us off the hook. You'll know, if you know the New Testament, that Jesus' teaching, and in fact the whole of the Bible's teaching, is at odds with, in fact it's at war with, self-righteousness. And to the extent that we as a community, as Grace Church, grasp the teaching of the Bible, by God's grace, to that extent, there should not be even a whiff of self-righteousness amongst us. You see, the Bible gives us resources to be a completely different kind of community different from either the religious or the secular forms of self-righteousness. The Bible enables us to be a people who are marked by true wisdom, true humility. And that's exactly what our passage today is addressing. I mentioned we've had a little break from Ecclesiastes, and it's probably best if we, especially for those who are relatively new, that we remind ourselves where we'd got to in the book. So the writer Solomon, he's the great wise man of the Old Testament. He is forcing us in this book to face the big, uncomfortable questions of life head on, and especially the question the book begins with, which is, what gain is there from anything human beings do? And especially, he goes on to say, what gain, especially in the face of death? And you'll remember from reading it that Solomon's favourite word, repeated again and again in this book, is vanity. And I've suggested that it would be better to translate it as vapour. Vapour, vapour. Everything is vapour. Not only is life foggy and we can't clearly see what's going on, but life is so impermanent, like vapour. No sooner do we try and grab hold of it and grasp it and understand it, and it's gone. And yet, while Solomon wants us to take seriously the fallenness of this cursed world, his message is basically a very positive one. And he's saying, look, there is a sovereign creator and judge. There is one who has a grand plan, who will make everything beautiful in its time. And actually, it's as we trust him and as we accept that life is more about gift than it's about gain, it's more about enjoying God and his gifts than it is about making a lasting impact. As we come to terms with this, we will be enabled to rejoice, he says, even in the midst of the frustrations and the fog. So there's a little overview of where we've come from. And in the previous part of this chapter, Solomon, his focus was on promoting a right humility before God when approaching difficult circumstances. And now in today's verses, he's commending this same humility, but this time focusing it on how it should protect us from self-righteousness. So let's get into the verses. Number one there on the sheets, true wisdom keeps us both from wickedness and from self-righteousness. And you probably picked up those opening verses give us warnings against different dangers. Look at verse 16. Be not overly righteous, and do not make yourself too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? There's one danger, and here's the other. Verse 17. Be not overly wicked, neither be a fool. Why should you die before your time? So you may remember that just as Odysseus, the Greek hero, he had to sail his ship between Scylla, the six-headed monster on one side, and Charybdis, which was the whirlpool on the other. Solomon tells us there are two different killers which could destroy us spiritually. One is there in verse 16, being overly righteous, or being, verse 17, overly wicked. Now, when you first read this, my first thoughts were, I could imagine somebody somewhere who's a believer who's living a double life, as I have before now, and it's a miserable way to live. But you can imagine that person who's got, you know, one foot with God and one foot in the world, and they latch on to these verses as their justification. And they get verses 16 to 18 as their memory verses. And they say, look, the Bible says that we're to be half-hearted. But it doesn't really say that. As we read on, we discover that what Solomon's urging is actually a wholehearted, devoted fear of God. And we see that when we get to verse 18. Verse 18, it is good that you should take hold of this, and from that withhold not your hand. So, i.e., it's good to take hold of both warnings in 16 and in 17. But how? Verse 18, for the one who fears God shall come out from both of them. Do you see the point? The way to avoid both dangers is a full-blooded fear of God. That is the one defense we're given against both of these monsters. And so we discover that Solomon was being quite cheeky. He has this tendency, and we'll have come across it before, where he says something shocking up front, and then we have to read on before we untangle what he's really saying, and it's a very naughty way to write, but it pulls you in. And we discover that Solomon's warning, therefore, isn't against true righteousness. After all, the Lord Jesus was perfectly righteous, and he wasn't over the top in that area. You know, you can imagine as if he was always taking this loving God and loving others thing a bit too far. Now, what Solomon is warning us about is merely cultivating the appearance of righteousness without the real thing. He's warning us against self-righteousness there in verse 16. You may know one of the big emphases of Jesus' ministry was declaring that what people admire in religion is not very often what God admires. And we had in our first reading, didn't we, the parable of the lost son, as it's called. And that parable is a masterclass in exposing that there are two different ways that human beings have for avoiding having God as Lord and Saviour. And one is the very obvious way, the way that Ecclesiastes 7:17 calls being overly wicked. And in the parable, that's the younger son, you'll remember, who runs away from his father, spends all the money on wild living. And you see that person from 50 paces, and you can sense that there is a lostness there. It's obvious. But there's another less obvious way to be lost, and that is what chapter 7, verse 16 of Ecclesiastes calls being overly righteous. And in Jesus' parable, that is the older brother who is outwardly in the right place. He's in church every Sunday, but he's potentially more lost than his brother, because in the parable, he ends up at the end outside of the feast, looking in. And Jesus, in this parable, he masterfully exposes how to diagnose this self-righteous older brotherishness, if there is a word, in ourselves. And in the parable, it's marked by a particular attitude to God and to those around us and to our circumstances. And this is a helpful diagnostic for us. So his attitude to God, and you'll notice in the parable there's a real lack of joy in his Christian life. All these many years I've been slaving away. There's a lack of assurance about the Father's love. You never threw me a party. But it's coupled with a specific attitude to those around us. And there's a tendency for this older brotherishness to come out in a tendency to comparison. Do you remember when this son of yours comes home, you fill the fattened calf? Why are they getting the blessings from God and not me? And that's linked to this judgmental spirit, you know, this lover of prostitutes. I'd never be like that. And finally, there's a particular attitude he has to his circumstances. When life doesn't go his way, he's not just sad, but in the parable, he's angry. I deserve better. You owe me, God. And all of that together is the portrait of the self-righteous tone. And Jesus is saying, beware. Now, Jesus' antidote to self-righteousness in that parable is to look at God's character, to trust God and to accept that he has this deep love for older brothers. But God's antidote to self-righteousness in this Ecclesiastes passage is to fear God. And what it will mean for us to fear God from this passage is specifically to humbly accept this vast chasm between God's majestic holiness and our grubby sinfulness. In fact, I've put there on the sheets, true wisdom, otherwise known as fear of the Lord, keeps us both from wickedness and self-righteousness. How? Well, point two, because it understands the depth of our sin problem. And that is what the rest of this passage now underlines for us. So let's look at the verses that follow. Verse 19. Wisdom gives strength to the wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. So he's saying true wisdom gives strength, practical help, to help people live life well. And here is what the wise person understands. Verse 20. Surely there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. And it's interesting, this isn't denying that there are righteous and there are wicked people in the world. There are people who know God and there are people who don't. And Solomon draws that distinction, for example, in verse 26. But here it's saying that even the righteous, even those who do know God, have this deep propensity to sin. And they do sin. Ecclesiastes, right from the beginning, has been calling us to reckon with just how broken this world really is. And again, he's been saying, don't live in a fantasy land and keep thinking you can build heaven here. You can't. And in particular, in this section, he's saying, don't start thinking you can live perfect heavenly lives here. You can't. And the rest of this section underlines just how deep our sin problem really is. And the verses go on as well to outline the difference it makes to us when we start grasping this reality. That's interesting. I think our society at the moment is gaining a renewed interest in the reality of human sin and evil. A lot of modern people have disliked the word evil because it implies, doesn't it, moral absolutes. Who's to say what's good and what's evil? And that's why, for example, there's been a preference for using medical language like dysfunctional behaviour to describe wrongdoing, rather than using right-wrong categories in our society. But I've noticed, and you may have as well, but just in the last few years, perhaps because of the high-profile child abuse scandals with Jimmy Savile, or perhaps because of increased terrorism, our media has shown a renewed interest in this category of evil to describe events and even to describe people. And it's because no other language seems to fit with reality. And actually, this is an opportunity for the church. It's an opportunity for us to contribute to the conversation, because the Bible's account of reality, that there is real supernatural evil, there is even real evil in the human heart, that worldview provides a much better explanation for what we see all around us than all the alternatives. Someone posted, this is a bit of light relief, but a spoofed satirical article this week from a website I like called the Babylon Bee, and it was on this topic of human sin, and the headline of the article was this: "Woman finally accepts doctrine of depravity, doctrine of sin, now that daughter is two." And in the article, Mary Eastwood, 29 years old, confesses, "I had the hardest time coming to grips with the idea that all the people I see around me are marred by sin and without hope but for the grace of God. But now that Charlotte is two, hoo boy, that innate depravity is shining through with the brightness of 1,000 suns." And the article concludes, "At publishing time, Eastwood was inviting an unbelieving friend to come to her house so Charlotte, the toddler, could convince her of mankind's radical corruption and desperate need for a saviour." The point is that having a right grasp of the depth of our sin problem really does explain the world that we see around us, including the world of toddlers. And in the next point, it also results in a new kind of generosity of spirit to those around us when we start believing this. And I've put there the resulting generosity of spirit. Let's look at verse 21. "Do not take to heart all the things that people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. Your heart knows that many times you yourself have cursed others." And he's saying, what makes the self-righteous person so judgmental, so intolerant, is their failure to remember just how sinful their own hearts really are. If somebody says something negative about us behind our backs, which is what verse 21's describing, of course it's hurtful, it's natural to be upset, but the person who blows up in self-righteous indignation, "I can't believe she said that," well, Solomon would say that person has a very skewed view of their own moral record. Solomon would say, verse 22, "Have you really forgotten all the times you have spoken negatively about others? Have you forgotten?" And this principle is very powerful, and it catches us out all the time, doesn't it? So I get irate about another driver who's just cut me up, happens all the time in London. And Solomon says, have you really erased from your memory all the times you have driven very badly? Or I get upset because someone ignores a message I send and I feel snubbed. And Solomon asks, have you really forgotten all the times you've done exactly the same thing to someone else? And Jesus takes this line of reasoning even further in the Sermon on the Mount. So when we hear the news story about a prominent figure who's cheated on their partner, and we tut in self-righteous indignation, and Jesus asks us, have you really never entertained a lustful thought about someone? Or we read about the latest barbaric killing, and Jesus asks, have you really forgotten about all the times you've had hateful thoughts in your heart? Are you so different from those people? The fact is that as forgiven people, we of all people don't have to pretend about our sin anymore. It's a great relief. It's been dealt with. And that should mean for us as a community that we can take our masks off at last. We can give up with any pretense of self-righteousness. And as we get this, it should be that our small groups are not full of shiny people all trying to project their perfect lives to one another, but rather full of real people who are honest about their sin and about their struggles. And it should mean, this is the particular point here, that we're the most generous-spirited people around, quick to overlook offences, because we know that while our particular symptoms might be different from theirs, we know we've all got the same sin disease. And as we grasp that, we will start cutting people a lot more slack than we do. And next, Solomon carries on expanding on this theme of our sin problem, but this time focusing on just how irrational our sinful hearts really are. And I've put there on the sheets the irrationality of sin. It doesn't make sense. Verse 23. All this I have tested by wisdom. I said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. That which has been is far off and deep, very deep. Who can find it out? I turn my heart to know and to search out and to seek wisdom and the scheme of things and to know the wickedness of folly and the foolishness that is madness. So here's his pursuit. Solomon wanted to understand wisdom and foolishness and why human beings behave the way they do. But, he says, it was even beyond him, the great wise man. And in particular, he wanted to understand, verse 25, the wickedness of folly, foolishness, and the foolishness that is madness. And he's saying there's something about folly, something about sin, which really is mad, insane, irrational. Sometimes if you or someone close to you is given to self-destructive behaviours, like self-harm or eating disorders or pursuing addictions or whatever it is, what makes that so painful and troubling is the irrationality of it. Why? Why do I do it? Why do they do it? It doesn't make any sense. But actually, all of us who sin, which I take it is in this room, all of us, have this irrational, self-destructive streak within us. Think about it. Given that God is the only source of real life, and that everything he commands is good and is life-giving, every time you and I choose sin over God, which we all do every day, we are in that moment choosing folly over wisdom. We are in that moment choosing death over life. That's where the sin will lead to. We are choosing, therefore, madness over rationality. And that is our human condition. And that, I take it, is why even Solomon couldn't fully understand human behavior. It baffles him. It's irrational. It makes no sense. And here is an example of it, verse 26. And I find something more bitter than death, the woman whose heart is snares and nets and whose hands are fetters. He who pleases God escapes her, but the sinner is taken by her. Now you need to know, Solomon's not negative about women generally. He personifies wisdom as a woman in Proverbs chapter 8. But this book, like the book of Proverbs, which Solomon also wrote, is addressed specifically to young men to give them wisdom for life. That's why, for example, Solomon addresses the reader as my son in the last three verses of the book. And that's why in this verse, the object of sexual temptation, naturally, is specifically a woman. And Solomon's saying, look, there is a kind of woman who hunts by night, and her trap is pleasantly baited. But he says, what she's offering is not freedom, but captivity. So men might kid themselves that the sexual immorality she offers is a kind of freedom, but it's pretty obvious it's not. It's a kind of slavery. That liberating sense of free fall doesn't last very long, and it always has spiritual consequences. And perhaps men will kid themselves that they're becoming truly human, but actually they are never acting more like beasts, just led along by animal instincts. And the point here is that her task is so easy. It's like trying to hit the ground with your hat. And apart from the odd exception where God in his kindness enables someone to escape, verse 26, pretty much everyone else falls for her obvious tricks. Even though a minute's reflection should teach us that that path is really more bitter than death. And it's a picture, I think, of just how irrational human beings are. Like Esau, you might know the story in the Bible, who sold his birthright for a pot of stew in Genesis 25. It's madness to act that way. And yet Solomon says it is in all of our hearts and it is very widespread. And Solomon continues, verse 27, behold, this is what I found, says the preacher, while adding one thing to another to find the scheme of things, which my soul has sought repeatedly, but I have not found. So he says, look, I've researched thoroughly. I've tried really, really hard to understand human behavior, but to be honest, the results have not been that fruitful. He goes on, one man among a thousand I found, that or better, one man among a thousand I grasped, I understood. But a woman among all these I have not found and grasped and understood. So Solomon found human behavior very hard to fathom. And as a man, naturally, he found women particularly mysterious. Another brain box, more recently, Isaac Newton remarked, I can calculate the motion of heavenly bodies, but not the madness of people. And then Solomon continues with what he started saying there in verse 27. So he started 27, behold, this is what I found. And now he picks it up, verse 29, see, this alone I found. What is the great sage's discovery after all his research? Here it is, verse 29. That God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes. If there is one thing that Solomon has learned after all his research, all his analysis, it's that human beings, though originally made upright, like those giant redwoods you see in the forest, straining upwards to the heavens, pointing upwards to God, which is how we're created to be, and yet, since our first ancestors, instead of growing upright up to the light, we have now turned in on ourselves. And he says, we're seeking out many schemes. And we are so acclimatized, we're so used to perverse human behavior that we don't even notice it. We think this is normal, but it's not. There was only one normal person in human history. There was only one person who lived like a human being was meant to live, upright. And the world is still talking about that one solitary, normal life. And what did we do? We killed him. That is how perverse we are. It's interesting, verse 29 does not simply say God made man upright, but now they're sinful. Did you notice? God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes. Which is to say, we have turned our wonderful creative energy given to us to help glorify God into sophisticated schemes, which I take it are to self-glorify and to self-justify. Think about how many wicked things are done in this world for justifiable reasons. And I would say nearly everything. Think of the adulterer who says, all I did was follow my heart. And in fact, it would have been wrong not to, really. Think of the thief who says, is it really so wrong for me to try and provide for my family? Think of the bully who says, well, I'm just someone who calls a spade a spade. People shouldn't be thin-skinned. Think of the gossip who says, well, the truth does need to come out sometime, doesn't it? Think of the thug who says, well, some people just need to be taught a lesson. Human beings are experts at schemes, at covering the truth about our sinful selves. And we are experts not just at fooling others, but we do a very good job in fooling ourselves. But, Solomon's saying, there is a great freedom which comes from abandoning this fantasy world and accepting the truth about ourselves and about one another, about the depth of our sin problem. And he concludes with the resulting cheerfulness. Look at chapter 8, verse 1. Who is like the wise? And who knows the interpretation of a thing? A man's wisdom makes his face shine, and the hardness of his face is changed. And this is the bridge which is taking us into the next section. But it's describing that whilst older brotherishness does make people stern and humorless and thin-skinned and prickly, like the person in verse 21, fearing God and accepting what Solomon has been teaching, perhaps surprisingly, actually leads, he says, to a deep cheerfulness. A shining face. The person who understands and accepts the chasm there is between God's holiness and my grubbiness is freed from all kinds of frustrations in this life. They're not forever idolizing others and then devastated when that celebrity, that friend, that Christian worker ends up being broken just like them. They're freed from putting their hopes in false saviors who are going to fix the world through education, through democracy, through creation care, through free trade, or whatever it is. They know that these solutions haven't correctly diagnosed how deep our human problem is. The wise person is not devastated by their own failures, as if God is somehow scandalized by their sin. No, God knew better than we did what kind of a person he was accepting into his family. And whilst he will be saddened by our sin, he's never shocked. He's never surprised by it like we can be. And that is deeply reassuring. And perhaps most significantly in these verses, the person who is truly wise, who fears God in this way, is freed from the terrible monster of self-justification. That insecurity of always having to build up our own sense of goodness. In fact, the wise person finds the idea of establishing my own righteousness not just unnecessary, but laughable. I mean, how can I establish my righteousness before a majestic, holy Creator God? And for all these sorts of reasons, there will be a resulting cheerfulness, he says, for those who fear God and accept his diagnosis of us. We began by thinking about how widespread self-righteousness can be and how the church, I argue, is the one place where we should be free from its stench. In fact, if you think about it from the New Testament, the kingdom of God is wide open to any kind of sinner, except for one. It's wonderful news. Whatever we've done, whatever our background, if we turn from our sin, if we ask God for forgiveness, we will be cleansed. But the self-righteous person, the person who refuses to accept their need for turning and for forgiveness, that is the one person who, whilst they persist down that road, can never be saved. You see, being people who are honest about our sin should be part of our DNA as believers. Week by week we gather, we say the confession, it's who we are. And that is why self-righteousness is so out of place amongst us.